Pharaoh had now conceived an interest in the subject of pregnancy and parturition, which temporarily rivaled his obsession with temples and tombs. I had to reassure him almost daily that the Lady Lostreet's rather narrow hips were no obstacle to a normal birth, and that her tender age, far from being prejudicial, was highly favourable to a successful conclusion to our enterprise. I took the opportunity to inform him of the interesting but little-known fact that many of the great athletes, warriors, and sages of history had been prematurely exposed to the light of day. "I believe, Your Majesty, that it's rather like the case of the sluggard who lies too long abed and thus wastes his energy, while the great men are invariably early risers. I have noticed that you, Divine Pharaoh, are always about before sunrise. It would not surprise me to learn that you were also a premature birth." I knew that he was not, but naturally he could not now contradict me. "It would be a most propitious circumstance if this prince of yours should imitate his sire and start early from his mother's womb." I hoped that I had not belaboured my point, but the king seemed convinced by my eloquence. In the end, the child cooperated most handsomely by overstaying its allotted term by almost 2 weeks, and I did nothing to hurry it along. The time span was so close to the normal that no tongues could wag, but Pharaoh was blessed with the premature birth that he had come to believe was so desirable. It was no surprise to me that my mistress began her labour at a most inconvenient hour. Her waters broke in the third watch of the night. She was not in the habit of making matters too easy for me. At least this gave me the excuse of dispensing with the services of a midwife, for I had little faith in those hags with the black dried blood crusted under their long ragged fingernails. Once she had begun, my Lady Lostreet carried it off with her usual dispatch and aplomb. I had barely time to shake myself fully awake, scrub my hands in hot wine, and bless my instruments in the flame of the lamp, before she grunted and said quite cheerfully, "You'd better take another look, Taita. I think something's happening." Although I knew it was much too soon, I humoured her. One glance was enough, and I shouted for her slave girls, "Hurry, you lazy strumpets, fetch the royal wives!" "Which ones?" The first girl to answer my call tottered into the room half naked and half asleep. "All of them, any of them." No prince could inherit the double crown unless his birth had been witnessed and it was formally attested that no exchange had taken place. The royal women began to arrive just as the child revealed itself for the first time. My lady was seized by an overpowering convulsion, and then the crown of the head appeared. I had dreaded that it might be surmounted by a shock of red-gold curls, but what I saw was a thick, dark pelt, like that of one of the river otters. It was much later that the colour would change, and the red would begin to sparkle in the black locks, like points of polished garnets, and then only when the sun shone upon it. "Push!" I called to my mistress. "Push hard!" And she responded lustily. The young bones of her pelvis, not yet tempered to rigidity by the years, spread to give the infant fair passage, and the way was well oiled. The child took me unawares. It came out like a stone from a slingshot, and the tiny slippery body almost flew from my hands. Before I had a good hold on it, my mistress struggled up on her elbows. Her hair was plastered to her scalp with sweat, and her expression was desperate with anxiety. "Is it a boy? Tell me, tell me." The room full of royal ladies, crowding around the bed, were witness to the very first act the child performed as it entered this world of ours. From a penis as long as my little finger, the Prince Memnon, the first of that name, shot a fountain almost as high as the ceiling. I was full in the path of this warm stream, and it drenched me to the skin. "Is it a boy?" my mistress cried again, and a dozen voices answered her together. "A boy! Hail Memnon, the royal prince of Egypt!" I could not speak yet, for my eyes burned not only with royal urine, but with tears of joy and relief, as his birth cry rang out, angry and hot with temper. He waved his arms at me and kicked out so strongly that I almost lost my grip again. As my vision cleared, I was able to make out the strong, lean body and the small, proud head with the thick pelt of dark hair. I lost count long ago of how many infants I have birthed. but there had been nothing in my experience to prepare me for this. I felt all the love and devotion of which I was capable crystallized into that moment. I knew that something which would last a lifetime and which would grow stronger with each passing day had begun. I knew that my life had taken another random turn, and that nothing would ever be the same again. As I cut the cord and bathed the child, I was filled with a sense of religious awe such as I had never known in the sanctuary of any one of Egypt's manifold gods. I feasted my eyes and my soul upon that perfect little body, and upon the red and wrinkled face in which the signs of strength and stubborn courage were stamped as clearly as upon the features of his true father. I laid him in his mother's arms, and as he found and latched onto her swollen nipple, like a leopard onto the throat of a gazelle, my mistress looked up at me. I could not speak. But then there were no words that could frame what passed silently between us. We both knew. It had begun. Something so wonderful that as yet neither of us could fully comprehend it. I left her to the joy of her son and went to report to the king. I was in no hurry. I knew that the news would have been carried to him long since. The royal ladies are not renowned for their reticence. He was probably on his way to the harem at this very moment. I dawdled in the water garden, possessed by a dreaming sense of unreality. The dawn was breaking, and the sun god Amun-Ra showed the tip of his fiery disk above the eastern hills. I whispered a prayer of thanks to him. As I stood with my eyes uplifted, a flock of the palace pigeons circled above the gardens. As they turned, the rays of the sun caught their wings, and they flashed like bright jewels in the sky. Then I saw the dark speck high above the circling flock, and even at that distance I recognized it immediately. It was a wild falcon, come out of the desert. It folded back its sharp wings and began its stoop. It had chosen the leading bird in the flock, and the dive was deadly accurate and inexorable. It struck the pigeon in a burst of feathers, like a puff of pale smoke, and the bird was dead in the air. Always a falcon will bind to its prey, and drop to earth with it gripped in its talons. This time that did not happen. The falcon killed the pigeon and then opened his talons and released it. The shattered carcass of the bird fell free, and with a harsh scream the falcon circled over my head. Three times it circled, and three times it uttered that thrilling warlike call. Three is one of the most potent magical numbers. From all these things I realized that this was no natural occurrence. The falcon was a messenger, or even the god Horus, in his other form. The carcass of the pigeon fell at my feet. Droplets of its warm blood splattered my sandals. I knew that it was a token from the god, a sign of his protection and patronage for the infant prince. I understood also that it was a charge to me. The god was commending him to my care. I took the dead pigeon in my hands and lifted it to the sky. Joyfully I accept this trust that you have placed upon me, O Horus. Through all the days of my life I will be true to it. The falcon called again, one last wild shriek, and then it banked away and on quick stabbing wing beats flew out across the wide Nile waters and disappeared into the wilderness, back towards the western fields of the paradise where the gods live. I plucked a single wing feather from the pigeon. Later I placed it under the mattress of the prince's cot, for good luck. Pharaoh's joy and pride in his heir were unbounded. He declared a nativity feast in his honour. For one entire night the citizens of Upper Egypt sang and danced in the streets, and gorged on the meat and wine that Pharaoh provided, and they blessed the Prince Memnon with every bowlful that went down their gullets. The fact that he was the son of my lady Lostris, whom they loved, made the occasion of his birth all the more joyous. So young and resilient was my mistress that within days she was well enough to appear before the full court of Egypt, bearing her infant at her breast. Seated on the lesser throne below that of the king, she made a picture of lovely young motherhood. When she opened her robe and lifted out one of her milk-swollen breasts, and before the assembled court gave the infant suck, they cheered her so loudly as to startle the infant. He spat out the nipple and roared at them in scarlet-faced outrage, and the nation took him to its heart. He is a lion, they declared. His heart is pumped up with the blood of kings and warriors. Once the prince had been quieted again, and his mouth stopped up with the nipple, Pharaoh rose to address us, his subjects. I acknowledge this child to be my issue, and the direct line of my blood and succession. He is my firstborn son, and shall be Pharaoh after me. To you, noble lords and ladies, to all my subjects, I commend the Prince Memnon. The cheers went on and on, for no one amongst them wanted to be the first to fall silent and bring his loyalty into question. During all of this, I stood with other servants and slaves of the royal household in one of the upper galleries which overlooked the hall. By craning my head, I was able to pick out the tall figure of Lord Tunnus. He was standing in the third rank below the throne with Nembet and the other military commanders. Although he cheered with the rest of them, I could read the expression on his broad, open face that he strove to disguise. His son was claimed by another, and it was beyond his power to prevent it. Even I, who knew and understood him so well, could only guess at what agony he was suffering. When at last the king ordered silence, and he had their attention once more, he continued, I commend to you also the mother of the prince, the Lady Lostris. Know, all men, that she sits now closest to my throne. From this day forward she is elevated to the rank of chief consort and the senior wife of Pharaoh. From henceforth, in name she will become Queen Lostris, while in precedence and preferment she ranks after the king and his prince alone. Furthermore, until the prince has reached the age of his majority, Queen Lostris shall act as my regent, and when I am unable to do so, she will stand at the head of the nation in my stead. I do not think there was a soul in all the upper kingdom who did not love my mistress, except perhaps some of the royal wives who had been unable to provide the king with a male heir, and who now found themselves outranked by her and superseded in the order of preference. All the rest showed their love in the acclaim with which they greeted this pronouncement. To end the ceremony of the naming of Pharaoh's heir, the royal family left the hall. In the main courtyard of the palace, Pharaoh mounted the sledge of state, and with Queen Lostri seated at his side and the prince in her arms, they were drawn by the span of white bullocks down the avenue of rams to the temple of Osiris to make sacrifice to the god. Both sides of the sacred avenue were lined 100 deep by the citizens of Thebes. With a mighty voice they demonstrated their devotion to the king and their love for the queen and her newborn prince. That night, as I waited on her and the child, she whispered to me, "Oh, Taita, did you see Tunnus in the crowd? What a day of mixed joy and sorrow this has been. I could have wept for my love. He was so tall and brave, and he had to watch and listen when his son was taken from him. I wanted to jump to my feet in all that throng and cry out, 'This is the son of Tunnus, Lord Harab, and I love them both.'" "I am pleased, for the sake of all of us, Your Majesty, that for once you were able to restrain that wayward tongue of yours." She giggled. "It is so strange to have you call me that, Your Majesty. It makes me feel like an impostor." She transferred the prince from one breast to the other, and at the movement he released from both ends of his tiny body a double blast of air, which in volume and resonance was truly imperial. "It is apparent that he was conceived in a windstorm," I remarked dryly, and she giggled again, and then immediately afterwards sighed dolefully. "Ah, oh, my darling Tunnus will never share these intimate moments with us. Do you realize that he has not yet held Memnon in his arms, and it is possible that he never will? I think I'm about to cry again." "Restrain yourself, mistress. If you weep, it might sour your milk." A warning which was untrue, but effective in bending her to my will. She sniffed back her tears. "Is there no way that we can let Tunnus enjoy our baby as we do?"